You cannot do everything yourself. You have to make sure that you delegate and you find people who are good at it.
Welcome to the Rehabcast, the official podcast of the American Congress of Rehabilitation Medicine and the Archives of PM&R. I'm your host, Dr. Bill Niehaus from the University of Colorado.
I had this experience where the nurse and the speech language pathologist couldn't figure out whether my father was actually not able to understand because of his brain, or was it because the nurse was talking in English? And there were no methods that were non-language based.
Let's welcome Dr. Mahim Masouf Adamson, whose vibrant father sadly suffered a stroke in 2007. This impacted his ability to communicate. Additional strokes impacted his aphasia further and ignited Dr. Adamson's pursuit of an innovative solution because...
So whatever happened to my father is not like a unique incident. It's happening to a lot of people.
To help patients like her father, she entered a faculty innovation fellowship and realized...
225,000 people a year in the U.S. suffer a stroke followed by an aphasia and depression, and 23% of them actually have another stroke.
Dr. Mahim Masouf Adamson is the director of a women's center funded by Congress at the VA Palo Alto, a clinical professor in the Department of Neurosurgery at Stanford University School of Medicine, and founder CEO of the medtech startup Souf Solutions. Tell me more about the process of building your idea into a functioning device built on Apple products to help with aphasia.
This is a wonderful way to launch into how our community, especially community at ACRM, can actually learn from how to develop their ideas into commercial products. So when you have an idea, a lot of people have a solution. They don't really have an idea. What they have is a solution. Oh, I'm going to solve this. The problem is you don't understand the need. So you have to first go back, throw the solution away. And it's very hard to do that because the solution is very close to your heart. You need to go back and figure out what the need is. And when you figure out what the need is, then you figure out your competition. What is your uniqueness that you're bringing to the table? What is your value proposition? And when I came into figuring this out, I thought I could do it on your iWatch, your Apple iWatch. Mm-hmm. I thought that I could do it using an external eye tracker. Then I realized that that is incredibly cumbersome for patients. It is very, very expensive. FDA taking a device to market is very hard. And it already exists. Headsets are very cumbersome for patients. You can't do that. So what is it that's the easiest? What is it that other than my child, I love the most every single day? It is my phone. Mm-hmm. Right? So if I wanted a solution, I wanted it to be on the phone. Now, I couldn't have come up with this solution, say, 10 years ago. The reason why is because the Apple augmented reality kit that is on the iPhone and iPad, which is this little thing that allows you to track your eyes, they've made that code available in the past four or five years. It wasn't there before.
Oh, wow.
I was doing this, and I was talking to engineers, and I was talking to everybody, and they're like, well, you know what? Why don't you just use that? So that's easier said than done, right? Because the way it's used on the phone is that it's tracking your eyes for looking at where you're looking, and then it's taking that information and somehow providing you more marketing things and stuff like that. We wanted to make it work so that it actually can grab a picture on the iPad, take that picture, and throw it to another phone. So actual interactive. So it took us about 8 months to work on that with a company. We used our first angel funds to get that programming going. We had to patent the solution. We had to get the programming. We had to hire a programmer. We did it through a company and we got it working. And then we, you know, started solving the issue of what is it that we need? So that technology was there. And then we had to figure out like, who's our customer and what do they want? And that's when we did our surveys. That's when we did our National Science Foundation grant that allowed us to do a ton of interviews. And we were able to talk to CEOs of device companies and, you know, other companies like Toby and people, speech language pathologists. And we realized our initial customer is a speech language pathologist, because they are with the patient, inpatient, outpatient rehab.
Right.
And they can recommend it to the patient and to the caregiver, and they can also recommend it to the hospital. Now, I'm on the hospital side because I work at two hospitals, and devices, people come to me all the time. They're like, we want you to do this in the patients. And I look at them going, I don't believe you. I need to talk to my nurse, and I need to talk to my SLP. And if they recommend it, then I'll buy it. So it's all those things that I didn't know as a scientist. And when you learn about how to develop a company, it's very exciting. It's also very terrifying and can get you very depressed at times, but it's a wonderful journey no matter what.
So as you kind of think about that path to where you're at now, what were the things that you found the most surprising in developing this new concept, this idea? You know, you've kind of mentioned that it ends up being targeting the speech therapist or a different domain than you thought of. Were there things, I don't know, I find that other inventors find things that they thought were hard way easier than they expected. And then there's these things that should be super easy that end up being your biggest stumbling spot.
So Bill, you hit the nail right on the head, right? So, and I'm just going to be very, very frank and bold with you, because as PhDs and MDs, and you know, people respect us a lot because we have a lot of knowledge about a certain thing, and we are very, you know, secure in our science, right? Well, the issue is when you commercialize the science and you scale it, you're getting into a territory that you really don't know what the hell's going on. So most CEOs or most founders who are scientific always need somebody who's financially driven, who understands the market, who understands the value proposition and what you're commercializing. So my biggest thing is that I can't do everything myself. I'm used to delegating at work, but I need a co-founder. I need somebody who understands the business, who understands the financial part, what the market is, what my pre-market value of the company is. All these words that I took for granted, they actually go hand in hand with the science. And it's really incredible how you can pivot the science based on what the commercial stuff is.
Tell me more about that. I think that's really interesting. And a lot of people are going to find that intriguing.
So, you know, one of the things that you that is very surprising is that when you come up with an idea as a scientist, you have a very strong focus on one idea and you only think about that idea and you're like, this has to work. Well, when you're making a company, what you need to realize is that what your idea is the crux of everything, but you can borrow tools from everywhere else to broaden it and apply it to all kinds of other populations. As I started talking to people, people are like, well, this is not just in stroke. You can actually help kill kids with developmental issues. You can help disabled people choose their food in a, you know, in a entertainment environment. You can help ALS patients. You can help intubated patients. You can do multiple sclerosis. All of these things were told to me. And I was like, yeah, you're right. But what's hard is to focus, because you know that there's a market for each one of them. I mean, the market for what I'm doing is $60 billion if you really look at it, with the stroke, depression, ALS, all of that. But you have to start somewhere, and you have to start with a focus on something that you can handle, right? And that's really hard to do, because you want to do, you know, you know it can apply everywhere, but you want to focus on one thing and you want to make sure that you can show that your solution works.
I want to make sure we take some time for the people who will listen to this podcast to talk about the device itself. And we can do this a few different ways. You can let me know what the best way is. I can try and take my stab at describing it, and then you tear it apart and tell me what I had wrong. Or we can kind of have you talk about the different interfaces and how the patient communicates with the caregiver, communicates with the provider.
Sure. I can actually, do you want to describe it, or I can just go on?
No, okay. Go for it. You'll do it better than I will.
The main idea is that you want to capture any stimuli on an iPad from a patient and throw it on the caregiver's phone. There's a reason behind that. It took my mother 15 minutes to understand that my father wanted a glass of water. It was horrible. just watching the frustration on my father's face, on my mother's face, and being married after 45 years and you can't communicate, it's just terrible. Mm-hmm. So what I decided to do was there's a lot of things that we had to think about. We were using an iPad because we want the visual feel to be bigger, mm-hmm. right? We could do it on an iPhone, but it's not big enough. The first set of stimuli that we created are just based on needs. So bathroom, water, you know, food, temperature, fall, moods, emojis. So their eyes literally can pick that stimulus, and it's a green box then kind of goes all the way with your eye tracking. And once it's captured, it goes to the caregiver phone. Now, the caregiver can be anywhere. We know as rehab scientists that there's a huge thing called caregiver burden. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be with the patient all the time. You could be in another room, but you'll get a ding that says there's something that the patient needs. Now, you have some time to say that you acknowledged it, that you are doing it, you're completing it, or it's the wrong request. Mm-hmm. And you have to go there and do it and then press the button. You have to be in a certain distance to make it, yes, I did it, because I don't want any caregiver, I'll do it later.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about the iPad that is facing the patient and their own personal device. Those two things have to be in a certain proximity.
So the iPad is with the patient, the phone is mm-hmm. with the caregiver.
Gotcha.
We made it in such a way so that it grows with the patient. Stroke mm-hmm. patients get better. So first it's eye tracking. If their voice comes back, then it can be used for voice command. If their hand control comes back, it can be used with touch. With ALS patients, it's the opposite. So they are understanding the words, so we can switch the pictures to words. But then as time goes on, they can't use their hands, so that we can go with their eyes. So it's the depending on the patients, it's very, very personalized. So our communication platform is done. So we can actually, it's in 5 clinics. Our SLPs are giving us user feedback. Our IRB is being reviewed this Friday. And so we can actually test it in patients. We're raising funds. We're going to angels. Our whole thing right now is that what happens with that communication? When that communication happens, you get a score. You get this data file. And the mm-hmm. data file goes to the provider. Because remember, there's three people, caregiver, patient, mm-hmm. and provider. The provider yeah. takes the data, and the data, there's global data that says it took the person this long to choose one stimuli. These are the number of stimuli they choose this day. This is what their response time was. This is what their accuracy was, blah, blah, how many were met. Those are metrics that are used to determine how they are doing in the program, how the interaction is. They may be correlated with their mood and things like that. All the eye tracking metrics, the saccades, the blinks, all of the fancy, fancy head movements, X and Y coordinates, they're going in the cloud. And that mm-hmm. is the meat of our thing, and that is the meat of our patent. And once we get the data, we are trying to develop an algorithm that can determine if things are normal within the patient or if they have gone beyond a certain standard deviation, so we can detect any weird neurological activity. That will take time because you first have to develop 2 weeks of their own, how are they responding? What mm-hmm. is their own resting state looks like? You know, I do brain imaging, mm-hmm. so resting state looks like. And once you have that and you've kind of put that through, then you mark different levels and say, okay, so this person, if he or she goes beyond certain, there should be an alert. At mm-hmm. that point, when we develop this, that's when we go to FDA and say, we are creating alerts for the provider and the patient, so we need to get an FDA approval for this. So we'll do a pre-market submission and all that. So that's the important part. That's the crux of what I'm trying to do. So I hope I answered everything.
Yeah, that's great. And I could see that being incredibly helpful. Like just thinking about like patients in the rehab unit or patients at home, you know, I really want to know that they're doing okay even when I'm not looking at them. I need to know when things are off on baseline or if their response time's decreasing during their rehab stay,
right.
or suddenly it's different today than it was yesterday, or any of that stuff would be super interesting and meaningful.
Absolutely. And then the speech language pathologist can have access to they can download homework to them.
Yeah. What's the most exciting thing that you see coming up in the next few weeks, next few months, besides crossing your fingers the IRB goes through when there aren't a lot of corrections?
What's exciting right now is that we are raising money. So we have, we actually made it on some rounds, some semifinal rounds. So we're raising money right now. We're talking to early investors. So that's very exciting for us. We are going to be running this in patience. So we are actually recreating our website with a marketing consultant. And we are going forward to actually take it to market and show it to SLPs and patients and actually market not just to SLPs, but also to patients and caregivers. Mm-hmm. And to me, that is the most exciting part, because when I see a patient and a caregiver duo get excited about my solution, about our solution, and they say things like, "What? I can just get it now? I don't have to wait for rehab to reimburse me? Mm-hmm. Are you telling me it can listen to me by my eyes?" I mean, that is to me, like, I can't wait for that to happen.
Mm-hmm. Your face just lights up talking about it, more so than any of the other spots. Not that you weren't smiling, but this, I can tell, is like the where the joy and the energy comes from.
Yeah, it's just the thought of it just makes me like, it gives me like goosebumps. That and my dream is that I will be able to, you know, you drive around in San Francisco. I don't know if you've been here, but San Francisco, Bay Area, you get into downtown and all the billboards are about apps and about devices. And there's nowhere on earth that it's like, because it's the hub, it's the IT hub. Mm-hmm. My goal is to have a billboard there that shows SOOF for every communication problem. SOOF. I want that. Like, that's my dream.
Yeah. SOOF it. Just SOOF it.
Just SOOF it. I think one thing I do want to say is that everything has to be patient-centered. And I'm preaching to the choir, because this is American Congress of Rehab Medicine. Mm-hmm. That's your motto. Every person who presents there, every person who's part of this organization is all about patient care. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, scientists may be a little bit different, but when we get into a field like this, we also change and we always have to think about patient-centered care.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you for joining us for this insightful conversation on aphasia and innovative communication solutions. Stay tuned after our brief commercial break as we explore compelling insights into outcomes for older individuals with traumatic brain injuries.
Discover the future of physical medicine and rehabilitation, an exhibition of innovative rehabilitation technology, products, and services where patients, caregivers, family members, and those working in the rehabilitation medicine field can meet and interact with exhibitors and discover the latest trends, technologies, products, solutions, and services. Join us Friday, November 1st from 5:30 to 8 p.m., and best of all, admission is completely free. It's all part of ACRM 2024 at the Hilton Anatole in Dallas, Texas. Go to acrm.org/expo for details.
It's very easy to say yes to opportunities that sound interesting on the surface, but I think the more valuable skill is to be able to follow projects to completion. And I think that's a really kind of the best skill you can have.
Welcome back. We're joined by PhD Ann Deitch and PhD Raj Kumar, who have been investigating the inpatient rehabilitation of older adults with traumatic brain injuries. Concerns about these types of TBIs, which frequently stem from falls, according to the CDC, has prompted their deep dive into the Medicare database. Before we start and join that conversation, I want to highlight the unique aspects of the Medicare database from inpatient rehabilitation centers. Specifically,
estimated in the paper, about 93% of people over 65 are covered by Medicare.
Plus, inpatient rehab centers are highly motivated to meticulously report outcomes data to Medicare, since
there's very little missing data because it is basically required, and there's a penalty if people don't submit a very high percentage of the data. So that was an advantage of this data set.
Now please welcome PhD Anne Deitch, who is a Senior Research Public Health Analyst at RTI International, a Senior Research Scientist at the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab, and Associate Professor at the Northwestern Medical School. Plus, PhD Raj Kumar is an Assistant Professor at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, and a faculty member at the Brain Injury Research Center at Mount Sinai. I really like how this conversation ramped up after asking them which aspects of the Medicare data they found initially interesting.
Yeah, certainly. I think we looked at comorbidities. Specifically, Medicare has these definitions of tiered comorbidities. So those are particularly costly comorbidities that facilities get extra reimbursements for. And we found a rise in tiered comorbidities over the study period. So that indicates that along with this rise in 28% of patients, they're also tend to be sicker. So we have more patients who are sicker. And along with that, the discharge disposition is more often home. So there was a rise in from 2013 to 2018 in discharge home after inpatient rehab and a decline in discharge to skilled nursing or subacute settings. So that was really interesting to us.
Are you saying that rehab works? And when we get involved with cases, people end up in different places than they would otherwise, potentially?
Yeah, I think that is certainly one explanation. I think changes in patient preferences and provider preferences over time that people are realizing across multiple stakeholders that people prefer to be at home whenever all else equals.
Makes sense. I mean, that's an easy plug for a rehab podcast to make there. Were there other insights or specific areas in the results that you want to comment on? I know you guys went through all the different domains of the various metrics we use to review an inpatient stay for a given individual, but I'm curious of other items that you want to make sure we talk about.
Yeah, I think adding on to what Raj mentioned, you know, even though the patients over time tended to have more comorbidities, the length of stay, we did look at the median length of stay, and that was the same across all of the years. And we also did look at variability across different lengths of stay groupings, and we did see less variability. It was just definitely, you know, fewer, longer stays. And so it was just many more stays that were, I think, between about 8 and 21 days or so.
That makes sense. And, you know, lived experience, that kind of correlates. Your rehab units, at least the ones that I'm involved with, are taking ever more complex, ever sicker patients earlier in their hospital stays and still, you know, working our rehab magic and getting people functional enough that they can get back home to the care of their loved ones and keep rehabbing there and making progress. When you think about kind of the next steps off of this, or when you think about how this is building towards new and different things, what are the things you see on the horizon? Or what, if you don't want to share your next rehab project, that's fine. But what are the things that you see coming along the lines that kind of builds off of your paper and adds to the body of research out there?
I think one thing that comes to mind is how this study focused on inpatient rehab. And the reality is, of among all post-acute care, inpatient rehab is only a small percentage. So looking at other locations where rehab occurs after the acute setting, skilled nursing, subacute, long-term acute care hospitals, and look at how patients who may be similar on the surface, if they're going to one setting or the other, how that may impact their long-term outcomes. I think that with the standardization of the data across these different settings, with the policy that I referenced earlier, the Impact Act, I think these type of studies will be possible in the future.
Makes sense.
Yeah, as Raj mentioned, like we in this study reported on the two types of functional status data for self-care mobility, the FEM was used throughout all of the years on the data set, 2013 through 2018, and then start because of the Impact Act, you know, which required standardized function data to be collected, the self-care and mobility data elements that are standardized across post-acute care were added in October of 2016. So we reported that data for the full years. So that's 2017 and 2018. And as Raj kind of indicated, those data are also collected in skilled nursing facilities, long-term care hospitals, and home health agencies. And so those data, you know, are available to be able to compare across post-acute care settings. So that is definitely an area where it would be really good to be able to compare the data in the future.
Yeah. You almost see it in 10 years from now, looking back from 2018 forward, or, you know, 2013 to 2023, and comparing it across multiple domains and things. It lends itself to lots of ideas and concepts and not that they're spinoffs, but building more of the understanding of what this whole post-acute care system actually looks like.
Right. And one of the other pieces of data that we report in the study that hasn't been reported that much is in our table 5, we report the number of minutes of therapy by OT, PT, and speech. And, you know, of course, in inpatient rehab facilities, in general, 3 hours a day or about 15 hours per week is expected. But as we indicated in skilled nursing facilities, you know, that data would be interesting to compare because they also do report the same data. So the data that's available on our data source, the IRF-PI, is basically the number of minutes during the first 2 weeks of patient stays. So we do report for the first week and the second week, and then we combine that. And that's the same data that's actually reported also on the minimum data set, or MDS, which is collected in skilled nursing facilities.
Excellent. Well said. It's almost like you've been doing this a while and you're pro moves there.
Yeah, actually, I have been involved in the IRF-PI data set for a long time. I used to work at the Uniform Data System for Medical Rehabilitation. So I have been involved in that data set since about 1994. Probably before 1994, but I've been involved in the updates to the data set for a long time. And I was part of the team that also developed the standardized function data, the self-care and mobility data elements.
Well, thanks for all your hard work. It's paying off for sure. Really appreciate it. If we were going to try and wrap up this or present what you guys did in a quick elevator pitch kind of thing, how would you kind of give me the meat and potatoes of what this study did and the big takeaways?
So I think this study puts numbers to the general growing, prevailing wisdom in the field that there's an increase in the number of older adults who have sustained TBI. And inpatient rehab is one lens to view that. We've shown in this time period from 2013 to 2018, it's been about a 27-28% increase, and patients are tending to be sicker and more often going home. And we also provide unique insights on some of the new data elements post the introduction of the Impact Act.
That's great. Well said. Thanks for joining us in this episode. We delved into innovations for patients with impaired communication and the pressing issues of traumatic brain injuries among older adults, both groups that are not only growing in size, but also in their vulnerability. I found these discussions really underscore the importance of tailored rehabilitation strategies that address the unique needs of our patients. As a healthcare provider, I feel called to adapt and innovate to ensure that our rehab populations receive the care necessary to not only recover, but to thrive. Before you go, I ask every guest a series of lightning round questions. I leave you with this episode's highlights and a few bonus questions they asked me. I enjoy having people talk about how they thank others and how they build that network and community. I really enjoy talking with Dr. Adamson about how she really engages with people who she finds helpful and how she builds that sense of community among the team she works with. She also highlights how COVID has impacted her ability to do that.
So you have like horizontal relationships with people. Not every relationship is vertical. And people don't do good work for you or help you in a good way if they're afraid of you. Mm-hmm. People help you and even if you're not their boss, because they like you and because they want to help you and because they may also realize that in my position, I can also help them. Mm-hmm. So I don't see it as scratch my back or whatever they call it. I'll scratch your back and you scratch my back. I see it as more of a community. And I feel like COVID took the community away. I feel like even the structure, the nuclear family and the way startups are and the way things are going, people don't rely on each other. They rely on their, you know, phones and all this kind of stuff. So I feel like human interaction and community is really important.
Next, I really like asking people, what's a piece of good advice you've received? And Dr. Kumar hit it out of the park, because it's interesting to hear researchers talk about the various ways they approach projects and how to streamline that process or the processes that you're working on.
It's very easy to say yes to opportunities that sound interesting on the surface, but I think the more valuable skill is to be able to follow projects to completion. And I think that's a really kind of the best skill you can have.
After thinking about which projects to get involved with, I'm also curious to hear what ideas people have changed their mind on. And Dr. Deitch really dives into an area she struggles with and thinking about, and a really, really funny story she talked about using AI and the paper that we just reviewed.
Yeah, I think for me, I guess with all the discussions about artificial intelligence, I go back and forth on how it might be helpful, but also how it's not helpful. And just as a quick funny story, perhaps, when this paper, you know, how when the papers get reviewed by the editors of the journal, they make changes and then you get the proof to review it. When I got the paper back and was reviewing it, in the paper we talk about bladder accidents and bowel accidents, and I believe some AI changed accidents to collisions with the, you know, idea that in general, you know, CDC doesn't like people to talk about car accidents, right, or motor vehicle accidents. And so I believe accidents got, like, just changed to collisions. And so when I saw the paper and I started thinking about it, I wondered if, like, medical terminology had changed and, like, bowel collisions and bladder collisions, kind of a new thing, and I was out of date. But then I thought, well, maybe it was just some artificial intelligence that just replaced accidents without anything, you know, considering any other word around it. And so, you know, that's an example of automated search and replace artificial intelligence that maybe isn't so intelligent that happened with this paper. So I kind of go back and forth on, you know, how AI can help us as researchers, clinicians, the field of rehab medicine, and maybe in some ways we just have to keep an eye on a lot of stuff because it's not always helpful.
I'm always curious to hear about what is someone's favorite age to be a rehab professional so far. Dr. Adamson doesn't disappoint when she talks about her favorite time and where she sees herself going from there.
I'm in it right now. I love it.
I had a feeling you would say that.
Oh, it's awesome. Because if I was younger, I was not confident enough. I was always like, I mean, I still suffer from a little bit of an imposter syndrome. I think all women do from, you know, not all, but lots of women
everybody.
Do. Yeah. To varying degrees, right? But I love what I do and I love being where I am right now because I feel like I'm on a launch pad. Mm-hmm. Sorry for the...
Ready to take off.
Yeah, ready to take off. Or, you know, just Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So realizing that what you do, the distance between what you do and how you can help people should be shorter. Everything we look at is immediate impact. Mm-hmm. So if I read anything, it has to be immediate. So to me, that idea of like, oh, I can take, you know, event-related task fMRI and I can take it to Pakistan and I can make everybody do it and it's going to be awesome, that doesn't fly. Mm-hmm. If you want to help people, you have to tweak your science.
If you're interested, they also asked me some questions.
Well, I want to know what your background is and how you got into this position.
Sure. I'm a neuro rehab doctor by training, brain injury board certifying. My job is mostly inpatient rehab or inpatient consults for rehab patients. It's about 80% of my clinical time, and then 20% is outpatient follow-up. Do some EMGs, do some Botox, and then follow-ups in the rehab unit. I'm also one of the long COVID docs out here at the University of Colorado.
Wow, you look very young to do all of that.
I'm older than I look. I got a young face and an old soul.
No, that's wonderful. So you understand exactly what need I'm trying to fill. So
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
My last question is, what makes you choose a bow tie? Because very few people wear it.
A few things. So I like being a little bit different, and a bow tie is kind of a way to say that I'm a bit of a geek, but I still look professional. I like that it doesn't hang down and get into patient care areas when I'm examining a patient or doing something like that. I like it because it's also a good visual cue. So I can ask patients to, like, take a look at my bow tie. Can you remember the color or the pattern? And then, like, use it almost as a memory test device later. Because not many people wear it. It's kind of like, oh, I talked to that guy with a bow tie, and everyone knows who they're talking about for the most part. And then the other reason, I'm a bit of a Doctor Who fan, and one of my favorite Doctor Who personas was Matt Smith, and he wears a bow tie.
I was going to say that. No, it looks great. It looks great.
Thank you for joining us today on the ACRM Rehabcast. We'd love to hear from you, your thoughts, your feedback, what topics you're interested in for future episodes. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you're listening right now, and share this episode with some friends, family, or loved ones. It will really help amplify and celebrate this incredible world of rehabilitation. I'm Dr. Bill Niehaus. Follow me on social media at NHAUSMD. And now the mandated promotional material in the style of an airline pilot.
Hello, passengers. This is your podcast captain speaking. We're currently cruising at 35,000 feet, and I have an exciting announcement for you. I'm turning off the fasten seatbelt sign so you can come join us at the 2024 ACRM International Rehabilitation Conference in Dallas. The core conference runs from October 31st to November 3rd. It's never too late to register. The weather in Dallas is expected to be with a chance with a high of 3 degrees. In case you can't make it, keep up with the latest updates on social media using the hashtag ACRM2024. Thanks for flying with us on Rehabcast Air, and enjoy your journey to the annual conference. Special thanks to our outstanding flight crew, Philip Robos and Jenny Ament, who produced this episode. Rehabcast music by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder.